here I am in a business that's growing quickly. We're raising tons of capital. I've got, you know, 200 full-time employees. We've got offices in a couple different countries. It was a forcing function for me to take some time off. I just couldn't go through the treatment to save my life while continuing to work. And it was the first time that I actually pulled back and tried to try out this kind of weird model of maybe working a little bit less would be better for me. And it wasn't that I had that great epiphany, like, stress is killing me. It was more of like, let me not die first, and then I'll come back and figure out what to do next.
Podcasting from Boulder, Colorado, this is the Baby Got Backstory podcast, where we dive into the story behind the story of today's most inspiring storytellers, creators, and entrepreneurs.
I like big backstories, and I cannot lie.
I am your host, Mark Gutman.
I'm Mark Gutman, and on today's episode of Baby Got Backstory, how a 17-year-old kid solved the problem of emailing guests for a single bed and breakfast client and turned it into a $180 million email marketing powerhouse. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to thank you, the listeners, for listening and your feedback and all your support. Without listeners, we really don't have a podcast, so thank you. I want to encourage you to keep this a dialogue. Email me your show suggestions, any thoughts or comments to podcast@wildstory.com, and I answer all those and look forward to your feedback. So if you remember the internet back in 1998, to be a kid with an interest in computers and programming, I mean, like, this was the golden age. It literally was the advent of the popular internet. I mean, by like 1998, things were getting really exciting. We were right in the thick of that first dot-com bubble. The web was becoming a household word. Like your parents weren't asking you anymore, like, what's the web? Everyone knew what the web was. And there was a sense that everything would be changing. URLs were starting to appear in mass media advertisements. Every stupid idea that had a .com was getting funding thrown at it. And there were all these like new desktop computers coming out, like with Windows 95, Windows 98, Mac OS 8, and they were all internet ready out of the box. No extra software needed. And Windows even came with a free bundled browser, Internet Explorer. And like before that, you had to pay for a browser a lot of times, like a browser like Netscape. Your email was provided by your ISP, your internet service provider, and that mail quota, how much mail you could store, that was like a huge selling point of your ISP. Free web-based email was just starting to appear at Yahoo and Hotmail. Connection speeds were so slow. LAN cards would not become a standard until around 2001. You either used a modem or you bought an add-in network interface card if you needed to go faster. And most people used dial-up internet access, with these new modems reaching peak download speeds around 56K, but most people were like at 40K. Some pros had ISDN network, but that wasn't common or affordable for most. 1998 was before Napster, before Google, before YouTube, iTunes, before Facebook, and before smartphones. Yahoo was like the roost of all directories, and AltaVista was the ruling search engine for contents of sites, and it was really, really slow. Upstart Google was just coming online in 1998. And there wasn't this idea of social media. The best thing that was going on then was AOL Instant Messenger and ICQ. We had chat. That's what was going on, chat. But things were happening, and small businesses were in a really tough spot. They couldn't afford huge tech shops to code their sites, and the knowledge to build a site and support it wasn't all that common either. Many small businesses started turning to young kids with an interest in the internet. Kids like Aaron Houghton, who grew up in a family with a father who was exposed to the early days of computing as a college professor. And as we'll hear, Aaron and his partner ultimately sold their company, iContact, to a public company, Cision, for a life-changing exit. But right when you'd think Aaron would be at the apex of his career, his world came crashing down, and he started to question what really made him happy. And this is his story. You know, Aaron, we're here to talk about your life and your story as an entrepreneur and your evolution to an entrepreneur who's built many, many companies and exited. And I'm told that you've started over 15 startups. You've had a lot of companies. Were you always an entrepreneur as a kid?
Yeah, I think I like to explore and I like to be adventurous is probably the best place to kind of think about maybe where my entrepreneurial story started. I did end up letting that adventure and kind of interest in being outdoors and biking and exploring new things kind of lead me into one of my earliest ventures, which was fixing up bikes. And so, you know, just bicycles, and I would sell them to parents of kids that I hung out with in the neighborhood. So my folks would take me down to a bike shop and we'd find extra parts that they'd taken off bikes that I could get cheaply. And we would typically start with frames that I got from the junkyard. And kind of my joy and interest in biking led to me wanting to buy better components for my bicycle, which I don't even remember at that age what it was. I remember later on saving up money to buy a Mongoose, a Sycamore was the model of the bike. Didn't even have suspension on it yet. And in order to buy those parts, I thought as a young kid, well, I could fix up other bikes and put cheaper components on those and sell them to people as functional bikes. And then I'd make a little bit of money to buy the parts that I wanted for my bike. So that was 9 and 10 years old.
That's awesome. Yeah. I had a, metallic sparkly blue kind of bass boat blue Mongoose that I loved and I rode all over the neighborhood. And so that brings back definite fond memories. And where were you growing up at this time? Like where were you raised?
So I was a young kid in Madison, Wisconsin and kind of central Wisconsin before that. And then, so that kind of story of fixing up bikes was where I moved when I was 7 years old and lived there for 4 years, which was in Fayetteville, Arkansas. So Northwest Arkansas.
Interesting. And then, so you went from Arkansas, were there any other entrepreneurial ventures before you got to college and kind of started the one you're most well known for?
Yeah, I did a little bit of mowing and landscaping work for folks in the neighborhood when I was in high school. So when I was maybe 13 and 14 years old, and I had two younger brothers, so I pulled my middle brother, closest to my age, into helping me with that business. And I took a drafting class in high school. And so we got to do kind of like technical drafting and 3D design. And some of the things that came out of that was the ability to take, kind of create stationery, like create business cards, create kind of 2D things that we could print out on the printing systems there. So the first collateral I remember making for any business was a small flyer that I created for the lawn mowing business. And it posed a unique challenge that I'd never run into before, which was, you know, before that it was just kind of Aaron and Damon who went around mowing lawns for people and they'd give us $20. And it posed the challenge of what is this thing called? So I had to give it a name. And we came up with the name, the Lawn Rangers. And so I built the first little flyer that said Lawn Rangers on it. And, you know, I didn't even have a phone number. I'm sure it was my parents' house's phone number that went on there. And I don't remember even handing it out to anybody. But that was kind of the first time I thought of, you know, hey, I've got to figure out how to communicate the value of what I do and put it on a piece of paper and think about maybe handing it to other people. And that business was pretty short-lived because I found my dad taught me when I was maybe 15 years old a little bit about HTML. And I got to sit in his computer lab down at the university and play around on some super high-powered computers that, you know, we would laugh at what the processing powers of those computers are today. But play around on these computers and build first kind of web designs for websites and put images and text and layouts. And I was immediately hooked. I realized this was a better way to make money and also a cooler way to build things than, you know, hucking lawnmowers around in the heat in the summer.
Yeah, totally. So wait a second. So like, when was this where you were experimenting in the family business of HTML at the computer lab?
Yeah. So dad was teaching middle grades education teachers. So teachers that would come out of the grad program at the university and be teaching kind of, I guess, 8th through 12th grade or something like that. Let's see. I would have been 13, 14, maybe 15 years old, somewhere around then. When I started playing around with HTML. So dad saw it as an interesting technology that he was teaching his students about to say, hey, you know, as a teacher, you might be able to teach your students how to do this. You might also be able to put things like the curriculum for the classroom online. You might be able to help your students, you know, use technology like this to do research potentially in the future. And I remember my dad telling me when I was playing at home on one of our, you know, early computers in a, you know, it was probably a 4800 baud modem plugged into a phone line at the time. Dad said something, this was probably in 1996 maybe, said, you know, you realize by next year, we're going to be able to buy all of our Christmas gifts online. And I remember as a kid just thinking, well, that's absolutely crazy. Like, think of what would have to happen. First, you'd have to be able to buy something online. Then you'd have to be able to buy everything online. How's that going to happen in a year? So I remember thinking about the internet at that very, very early stage when there really wasn't anything to connect to on the internet.
Yeah. And I was really trying to, you know, set the stage. And I think you did a good job there that like you're learning HTML, but like no one really knows what it's for. This is an emerging technology. It's not common. People aren't throwing up Squarespace websites. So you just had this interest and this access to this incredible language and this technology. Did you have like any insight then when you were playing around with it that you'd be going into that as a career, or was it more just something that you fumbled around with?
You know, it's weird. I didn't have a lot of folks in my immediate family that ran businesses. So it's kind of odd that somehow my first thought of what to do with this thing was to support businesses. And I created over Christmas break, I think that year, a website for a fictitious business called the Georgetown Mall. And I'm guessing this was some sort of shopping mall that I thought existed in a place called Georgetown, which I'd never been to before. And so I just created this directory site that had links to stores that I had made up and kind of started thinking about what this would look like for a business to use. And I don't know what really got me there other than that, you know, I'm assuming my dad must have planted a seed in my head at some point that this might be a better way to make money than mowing lawns.
Yeah, but you're like, you're making this up on the fly. You're literally like inventing the internet to some degree, right? You're like, you're pushing into new space, which is super cool and interesting. And so like, you know, most kids, you decide you're going to go to college. Did you enter the University of North Carolina as a computer science student, or was that something that evolved? How did that happen?
You know, it was kind of a weird time. When I started college in 1999, you got to think back to kind of the dot-com era was really rising. And then while I was in college, obviously the fall of the dot-com bubble. And there was a lot of thinking in the US at the time that software developers were going to be outsourced forever, right? So it was kind of the early rise of offshoring technology. And, you know, this concept of a flat world was kind of coming out that we could, you know, technology could be built or designed in the US and then built in the other 12 hours of the day and on the other side of the globe, and then kind of using this sort of worldly model in order to build software collaboratively across the globe. And the thinking behind that was that software developers, you know, could and might for the most part in the future not be in the United States. And it was a weird thing to be thinking about as a student entering the university and wanting to go into technology. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, what is this career path going to look like in the future? And I think one of the things that came out of that uncertainty is that I decided to myself that I needed to figure out how to make money as a technologist instead of maybe just necessarily relying on the career path that might otherwise be laid out for me.
At what point did you start to noodle the idea? What was the genesis of the idea for iContact?
So it's really interesting. I think one of the things that people often get wrong about my story, and maybe a lot of other entrepreneurs, is that I'm known for iContact, obviously, because it was a nice success, and we had a lot of users, and we made a lot of impact with that business, and so that's great, right? The history's written by winners, and so the bias that comes out of that is that, you know, people think that was kind of, you know, at some point Aaron sat down and maybe thought of this idea and built it and hoped some customers would come along. And the story really starts several steps before that. So as you mentioned earlier, I've, you know, if I draw the bar at, you know, a startup being a company that I built software for that provided some type of solution and someone paid me more than $1 for it, then you get to about 15 companies that I've created over my 20-year career. And iContact was really an idea that came from a customer in my consulting business. So I call it a consulting business, but I took my skill for building fictitious websites and turned it into a skill for building websites for actual businesses. And I started with the first one I created was for my basketball coach, my JV basketball coach in high school. His family owned and ran a bed and breakfast in a small tourist town in Western North Carolina called Dillsboro. And the business there was called the Jarrett House. It had a restaurant and had hotel rooms in it. And because of the type of business in Western North Carolina in the Asheville area where I was going to high school, you know, a lot of business out there is done pretty much this time of year, actually. It's in September and October when the leaves change color and tourists come up. So I got into the business of working with a lot of tourism-driven businesses. So these were typically accommodations-type properties. Some of them actually worked with the county and the tourism organization a little bit. And so I was working with all these businesses that had a lot of really seasonal traffic. So people were coming in for, let's say, 60 days out of the year. They did most of their business, and then the rest of the year, things were really, really quiet. And so they were looking at digital technology as a way to stay in front of these audiences. So I was building websites for lots of these little inns and cottages and bed and breakfasts and hotels. And so I started building a couple of different products that I thought might be interesting to that audience. And one of my consulting customers, a web design customer, came to me and said, you know, this website that you've built for me is really interesting. And I love being able to, I built with some, just a little bit of scripting knowledge, coding knowledge back then, a way for her to update a message on her homepage. And so she could log into the back end and change some text that would change on the homepage for visitors coming to the site. And this was kind of unheard of or cutting edge, or certainly not something that small businesses had back then. And she said, wow, this is really cool to be able to update messages to my customers on a daily basis. I can tell them it just snowed, come visit, or I can tell them, you know, the toilet's out and unit 3, don't book it right now, right? So lots of opportunity to stay current. Websites were mostly static brochures at the time. And she came to me and said, can I take this website with my updated text on it, and can I send that to people over email with, you know, cool looking fonts and colors and text and images? And that was really just barely possible at the time with the beginning of HTML email. Email had been mostly text only before that. And so I thought, hey, you know, I think the stuff that I'm doing for web layouts could be sent through the email spec. Let me try and see if this thing works. And so that's where the idea came from. I built this as something that I thought would be kind of an interesting project for Michelle and her company, Mountain Brook Cottages. And she started referring me to other tourism customers pretty quickly.
Wait a second. Like, how old are you at this time? You've got a consulting business. You're niching down, right? You're doing the thing that everyone says to do. You're finding a niche in this weird kind of inns and lodges. You have Michelle who's getting excited. But like, A, how old are you? And B, like, I'm still kind of caught up on this technology. I mean, are you sending these emails over AOL? Is it weird, like Excite and Yahoo accounts and Earthlink accounts? I mean, like, you're still really young at this time.
Yeah, so I would have been 17. Yeah, so it would have been 1998. So we're, you know, we've backed up to pre-college now. Yeah.
Clearly, everyone's looking at you because the older generation says, we have no idea how this works. And I remember even my first business website, I mean, everything was done by a developer. There was no ease of use. There was none of this, you know, you have a real easy UI and you can go in and type, hey, have a happy day. The toilets are out or whatever. Yep. I mean, it was a really laborious thing. Walk me through a little bit, like, how difficult is it to like build these websites and what's going on and what kind of challenges are you encountering with the email client? Because even I remember just sending like an email with like some weird fonts, it was like a 1 in 2 million chance that was going to come through on the other side clean, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember back pretty far to remember the environment I'm operating in here, right? So these emails are landing in downloadable email client inboxes, right? Eudora, I believe Netscape evolved into, I think Netscape Communicator had an email inbox, if I'm remembering that right at the time.
They did, yeah.
Yeah, who else? I just remember Eudora is the big one. I think they were probably the market leader when I was starting. And so it was relatively simple. So no, people were not loading these in you know, Gmail or even maybe Hotmail right on the front side a couple years in. Considering the skill set I had at the time, it was pretty easy. You can look at it a couple ways, whether I just kind of lucked into having the kind of digital literacy that I needed in that moment to have the tools in front of me. I think you can give my dad a lot of credit for guiding me as an adolescent into an area of something that might be interesting and might be prosperous in the future and kind of letting me find problems to solve there. But actually putting the pieces together, you know, I probably wrote the first version of the app. It didn't even have a database behind it. It literally wrote people's messages and email lists to flat text files that were numbered and stored in a file system on the server. I probably wrote it in less than a week, certainly a matter of a couple of days. And I had all the pieces in front of me. You could hand off these HTML constructed, you know, documents, essentially bodies of the message, into email systems, and they sent them along as if they were text. And then you just had to make sure that when it popped out on the other end, to your point, in the email clients that actually mattered, that it looked right. So there was a lot of trial and error, making sure Michelle's messages looked right. And what I actually started to learn out of that was that there was a whole second version of HTML, and this existed for a long time. Basically HTML that worked over email and HTML that didn't work over email. So you couldn't do things like setting an image as a background in a table or a field or a layout or something like that over email, but you could do that on the web. Later email clients, especially web-based email clients, added even more restrictions because of web security and other things that you could take advantage of by sending, you know, dynamic documents into a web browser, an email client that was loaded in a web browser. So email actually became kind of a smaller and smaller pipe in terms of the creativity that you could use with HTML. And through pure trial and error, I figured out what worked and how to make these messages be as simple as possible so that they looked correct and they looked professional when they arrived in the inbox.
Yeah. And I imagine, like, as a 17-year-old, you're just doing it, and you know, that nothing's impossible, and you're out there and working on this challenge and you're successful. But at any point, were you thinking, I'm like really onto something, or this is like crazy? This is just, I'm building something that doesn't exist? Or were you just kind of living in your own world for the time being, thinking, hey, I've got some cool clients, I'm just doing what I love to do, making a few bucks? Like, what was your mindset back then?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's about a 2 to 3 year period from the first emails I sent for clients and adding a couple other clients through to the point that I really started focusing on commercializing this product. So you can almost draw it out from like junior year of high school all the way to junior year of college before I really realized what this thing was. So being an inventor type mindset, you know, I'd invented it, and so I was clearly done. My work was over. So when people came along that wanted to buy the product or use it, I accommodated them despite their annoyances, like sending me money and asking questions and things like that. You know, I had invented this thing, and I was proud of it. And so I went on to invent other things. I built a couple pieces of software through my first couple years of college. I worked with a lot of consulting clients, picked up more tourism businesses that I was building websites for. And I would occasionally mention to them that I had this email tool, and oftentimes they'd take me up on it and pay a couple bucks a month in order to use it to promote their business. And in some ways, I was a little bit ahead of the trend because I had this powerful tool, but not every business was collecting email addresses of their customers at the time, right? So they had mailing addresses, physical mailing addresses, and then they talked to their customers through maybe TV or radio advertising, but they weren't all collecting an actual email address to make my tool actually useful. So a couple years later, and I've got to give my future co-founder in the iContact business, Ryan, when I met him, I didn't meet him till the beginning of my junior year at Carolina. He had used a tool similar to this, and he'd used it. It was a product company that had been collecting email addresses when he was an intern in high school back in Bradenton, Florida. And we started talking about some of the technology that I'd built. I had this software that managed K-12 schools. I had software that mined data for student body president candidates on inside campus environments to learn about their audience. I had a couple of these different products, and then I had this email marketing product. And we kind of went through them one day over a casual conversation in Chapel Hill. And Ryan said, wow, that email thing is actually amazing, because in my internship, I was using this piece of installed downloadable software that did the same thing. And we had maybe 100,000 email addresses in this business he was working in. And every time they went to send out the newsletter, it did two things. It tied up that computer in the office for like 3 days as it sat there and cranked out sending all these emails. And it tied up pretty much all the internet bandwidth in the office as it sat there and sent the emails out of the actual office over their local bandwidth. And he looked at what I had and said, wow, this thing's web-based. So I literally hit send, and then I just move on to the next thing on my computer. And I said, yeah, absolutely. It all happens out. You know, I wouldn't have used the word the cloud back then, but that's the concept we would call it today. It happens out on servers on somebody else's bandwidth, and the customer doesn't necessarily need to know where it happens or how it happens, but it happens. And he said, wow, this thing's pretty amazing. You can get use of a computer that after you send the message, it's actually usable for the next 3 days. You don't tie up all your local bandwidth. Heck, you could even send multiple messages at once. This was kind of groundbreaking for someone who'd come out of the same use case, but seeing it in desktop installed software. And I think the most interesting thing Ryan said to me in the beginning was, we paid $1,400 for that piece of software. And I'd been selling the online software through a subscription for like $9 a month. And so the thought of there being some value, we could kind of close the gap on that value. What if we charged $50 a month? We would still be cheaper than the alternative out there. And we have these advantages where we don't tie up your bandwidth and tie up your computer. I think that's the first time I realized that there were people out there really paying real money to solve this problem. And my tool that I had built had some advantages over everything else.
Wow. So like before you, the light bulb goes off for you and Ryan, like how much money were you just making loosely as a college kid, as a consultant?
Doing consulting work, I think my senior year, I built $80,000 is what my tax return would have said, top line. Didn't have a lot of expenses. I did have an office down Chapel Hill, which everyone called the clubhouse, and we drank a lot of beer there. But I did do some work in that office during the day. And on some of these tools and products that I was working on, I'd recruited in other friends that had come and joined me. So some of them were working on other different software projects or even product companies, but became kind of like a little incubator in downtown Chapel Hill. Everybody that was doing something interesting just kind of hung out in the space, and we'd often find ourselves up there till 10, 11 o'clock at night till the bar next door cranked up the band, and then we'd walk over there and have a beer and decide maybe it was time to stop working.
Yeah, I mean, I just imagine like going back to that, you must have been like the computer science rock star, right? It must have been like, Aaron, like, you know, like, I mean, things are happening. Like my college experience was, you know, living on $20 a month and just trying to get through school. And here you are making as much money as, you know, most people hope to make 10 years out of college and also having a great college experience. So were you just like this, you know, kind of computer science, you know, celebrity at Chapel Hill, or was that common amongst your peers and classmates?
Everyone else, at least that I remember, seemed to be on much more of the career path. And I talked about earlier why I kind of got disenfranchised on the career path, because I honestly thought it wasn't going to exist. I literally thought as a 21-year-old that if I wanted to be a full-time career software developer, I probably needed to move to India. That was just what was happening in the trend at the time. And the bubble had bust in the US, and I think everyone just thought that tech jobs were also going to go with them, right, across the globe. So everyone around me in the computer science department that I interacted with was really thinking about the job track. And I remember that, you know, the big internships were Microsoft and IBM. There's a lot of connections between Fred Brooks, who founded the computer science department at UNC, was a big, well-known IBMer. And so that was kind of the path where the best and brightest went. I never felt like I certainly was not the smartest computer science student. There were some absolutely brilliant peers and classmates that I had there. And so those paths always seemed, you know, in my mind to make sense for them. I've always figured the big companies wanted the absolute smartest people and they'd figure out what to do with them from there. And I kind of thought of myself a little differently. One, I wasn't super interested in that being a career path because I just thought that, you know, my job would probably get cut 3 years later as it got offshore. I just still had this kind of stuck in my mind. So I never really considered that. And then I also, you know, I don't think I had the confidence to think that I could, like, you know, solve computational problems, outsolve everybody else. And so I didn't feel like I was going to be in the top 5-10% of my class. And I also had this little bit of weird experience that I was selling stuff to people. And I would say I can't think of anyone else of my computer science peers that I spent time with at Carolina that had that other side going on, that actually were selling software or, you know, software subscriptions to people as a student. So kind of in that hand, I had this thought of like, well, that can't be that hard to do. You know, it can't be that hard to do a lot more of this. I remember at the time, the professors talking about the average starting salary for grads from the computer science program, and it was $55,000. And so that was I graduated in 2003. And so I remember thinking, well, you know, there's a lot more opportunity on the table. Because, you know, I found it not that hard to make $80,000. So maybe there's more I can do by just following this path.
Take me through the next steps. At what point did you and Ryan sit down and say, you know what, we're really going to make a run at this thing. We think that this could be something bigger than our college side hustle.
It took us about a year. So about a year later, it was July 2nd of 2003, right after my graduation. In May 2003, that we decided to actually incorporate a company around this product. So the product existed in my consulting business, and I hired Ryan as a marketing consultant because he said, "Hey, I've learned some stuff about guerrilla marketing online," because that's kind of what he was doing at this other business, and email marketing was one of those components. And he said, "You know, I know the product because I've used it, and I know guerrilla marketing because I've spent some time thinking about this. Let me think about how I can do that for this company and this idea. And if this works, do you want to work on this thing together. And I said, well, you know, I have nothing to lose. Let's, you know, I've built it. Why don't you see who you can get interested in it? And he immediately had some feedback for me around, you know, here are one or two other features that the other piece of software had that we used that this doesn't have. Can you build them? I said, great, I'll get started on those. And he went out and started doing some guerrilla marketing tactics, like kind of early SEO, building content sites and optimizing and writing lots of articles about, you know, what is email marketing and kind of evangelizing the space. And so over that year, he and I didn't work together really that closely. He was paid as a commissioned marketing consultant and got a commission of sales that actually closed. And so we kind of just went on our way that year. And so I was watching the numbers, and he was off doing his work from his dorm room on South Campus at the university. And I'd see a little bit more traffic arriving to the site, and then I'd see a sign up, and then I'd see a trial, and then we'd check back in a few weeks later. And as that year played out, I had just graduated, and I was coasting a little bit on the consulting revenue. You know, the 80K was the top line. I had contractors working for me and other people. So I don't know what I was putting in my pocket, but it was probably maybe closer to like 20 or 30K or something like that. So I was living a pretty meager lifestyle and just kind of getting by month to month and trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And I keep watching the numbers kind of ticking up and ticking up. The email marketing product at the time had less than $1,000 a month in revenue is where I got it to. And so we start getting traffic from these SEO sites and content sites. We start getting people signing up for the trial automatically, people that I don't know. We get people using it, people upgrading at the end of the 15-day trial, and we really start to have a funnel. And so Ryan and I are watching these numbers, and over that year, we get the 1,000 a month, or less than 1,000 a month. I think it might have been like 600-700 a month. We get that up to about 3,000 a month. And so now it's starting to actually look really interesting, first of all, because 3,000 a month is an amount that he and I could both live on at the time. So for me, it's looking like, hey, this could be something sustainable that we could actually spend a little bit of time on. And so we decided to really put all of our eggs, or most of our eggs, in that basket. Ryan had another venture he was working on. I still had my consulting business, which I actually continued to run until 2010 as well. And we said, all right, let's spend a serious amount of effort on this and try and make it work. And so we wrote a licensing, or had an attorney write asset purchase agreement. And we purchased the software out of my consulting business out into a new Delaware C corporation entity that we had a startup attorney set up for us. And so we acquired the asset over into that company. And now Ryan and I were the co-founders of this thing. And we said, all right, let's see if we can get it out there in front of a bigger audience.
Cool. So, like, now you've gone through this legal process, and you know I know what that's like, and you have all this excitement, and I can only imagine that then the next day you're sitting at the kitchen table and you're kind of looking at each other like co-founders, and you're like, now what? So, did you guys go out and raise money? Did you go out and bootstrap? Like, how did you start this venture?
Yeah. It's one of my favorite details about our story, because I also think it's easy to get wrong, especially in today's startup world, where, you know, you start with an idea on a napkin and then you present it to, you know, Brad Feld or another famous venture capitalist, and they give you lots of money, and then you have a business, and then you go try and find some customers. I feel like that's like the model that is out there, and it's really nobody's fault. I think it's kind of like the white sugar refined version of the startup story, right? It's really easy to like. And in our story, I think it's easy to kind of twist and make it look that way too. So we raised $65 million in total over the years, about 45 to 50 of that in equity and the rest of it in debt. And so you can look at it and say, oh, they raised a bunch of money to grow this company. But we didn't actually raise a single dollar from anybody until we were at about a $3 million annual run rate. And that's because we had very little cost. I'd already built the product. It was working good enough. It wasn't a great product, but it was working good enough. Didn't have the capability to scale, but we'd figure out those problems later. Didn't have a bunch of features it still needed, and we'd figure out those problems later as we built out our team. But what we had Ryan's ability to build content sites and drive traffic in, and then he also decided to start playing around with AdWords. In 2004, as we started to get a little bit more cash coming in, we thought, hey, you know, we actually have more than we need. Let's spend a little bit in AdWords and see if we can drive paid traffic in. And we were one of the first people on AdWords, and we were one of the first marketing businesses on AdWords, and we were one of the first email marketing businesses on AdWords. And so there wasn't a lot of competition for the terms for the type of traffic we wanted to buy around email marketing, email newsletters, send a newsletter to my clients online, all these different terms that people were thinking about in the early years of email marketing. And we were able to start dialing it up. And the amazing thing that you know, if you, I like to help entrepreneurs think about, you know, what is the economic engine inside your business? It comes from Jim Collins' Good to Great content as well, from the hedgehog concept, right? Like one of those components is what is the economic engine, your profit per X or whatever that can grow your business. The amazing thing that helped us grow the business was that we had this like inverted cash cycle. So we could spend money on a Bank of America credit card that was approved with a $10,000 limit, and Bank of America wouldn't back it at all. So the SBA had to underwrite it for us. So this SBA underwritten Bank of America 10K max Visa credit card, we could put $2,000 on it and we didn't have to pay them for 30 days. And that would drive traffic into our site that day, the day we spent the money, because we could buy that much traffic in one day. Someone would sign up for a 15-day trial, very important. We just made up 15-day trial, or we copied it from someone else, and it wasn't strategic. But people would sign up for a 15-day trial. At the end of 15 days, they would decide whether to upgrade or not. About 20% of them decided to upgrade and pay us. And of those people, about 20% of those people actually decided to pay us in advance for a year. The rest of them just paid us for the first month. Either way, our customer acquisition cost at the time was actually lower than 1 month's top line, you know, cost on the subscription. We had almost no, you know, cost of goods sold to deliver this. It was all digital and went out of our servers over the internet. So the point behind all this is I could spend $2,000 on the Bank of America credit card on a Monday, and then 15, 16 days later, I'd have more than $2,000 in my bank account, and I'd still have another 2 weeks before I had to pay Bank of America off without incurring interest. And so we had people paying us before we actually had to deliver the money to pay for the advertising costs that were required to get them to our site, into the trial, and get them to upgrade and pay us. And this became our economic engine. And once we realized this, and we realized that the customer acquisition cost was super low at the time, and we were making a good amount off of them over time, we realized that the only thing that we needed to increase was the amount of cash we could shove into the top of this funnel. And that's when we went out to start raising capital. We finished that year at $2.7 million in revenue, and we just wanted to go faster because the numbers kept holding. So we went out and raised $500,000 at first, put it into advertising, went actually a year on that money. We raised that in 2006, 2007. A year came later, they decided to do an additional tranche and of another $500K. And then we went out and found a proper Series A investor that decided to give us, I think it was $5.5 million to just keep feeding the beast, basically. And that cash efficiency continued in the business till about 2009, 2010.
That's crazy. And so when you guys incorporated, was the name initially iContact, or where did that come from?
Yeah, so it had lots of iterations. When it lived under my consulting business, it was called, so the consulting business was called Preation, P-R-E-A-T-I-O-N, and that was the words page and creation smashed together to find an available domain name in, you know, 1990. I'd love to look up on Whois and see what year I actually registered Preation.com. I still have it. I would imagine it was 1997 or 1998. And so the email product was called Preation List Blaster Pro. That's what happens when you put a computer scientist in front of putting a product name on something. So we then, when Ryan and I launched it together, we renamed the product IntelliContact Pro. We liked pro on the end of it, I guess, since we were like two of the least professional people on earth. We thought maybe if we could slap pro on the end of things, people might think it was a professional product, and it worked. And then as we started to grow, we had probably at least 5 million in revenue, maybe even 10, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 million in revenue. We decided to try and shorten it even further down to the iContact name. And we went out and bought the domain name iContact.com. And small startup world story. I'm sitting here in Boulder now, where I've lived for almost a year, and that domain name I bought from a guy named David Cohen, who had a failed mobile social media startup called iContact.com at the time. He wanted to sell us the whole business, and we just wanted the domain name. And he was sitting in a coffee shop here in Boulder, Colorado, and shortly after we bought that domain from him, which he's actually written about, which is fun, we paid him $25,000 for it. He went on to co-found Techstars with Brad Feld, which is now an organization I'm involved with here in Boulder. So the world has come full circle on that one.
Yeah, totally. It's crazy how that all connects for you and comes around. And that's interesting. I had assumed that eye contact was this sort of brainchild of, you know, everything was I something at the time. You know, the iMac came out, I think, in 98-ish. And, you know, and then there was I everything. And that just made you seem very internet-y at the time, you know?
It was. And I think it was kind of dumb luck that IntelliContact started with an I. And we thought, hey, we could just take out a bunch of letters in between and kind of align with this trend. So it was definitely part of the thinking that an I name might be a good idea. You know, if we'd been founded 5 years later, it would have ended in .ly, right? Or would have had a few vowels removed from the name as that became popular. But yeah, we came up with it and deciding kind of we're getting to scale and wanting a more scalable brand name right in the period of the I everything.
Totally contactly or something, right?
You got it. Yeah, it would have been iContactly or something. Yeah,
contact.fm. Got it. So you and Ryan, you're high five and things are going well. You guys are ratcheting it up. You're improving the product. You're running a business. I mean, I can only assume that it's not all sunshine and rainbows, right? Like, so let's not just gloss over and make it seem like, you know, there was no work to be had here. You guys are working really hard, but you're on your way and things are going great. And then what happens?
As I think back on my entrepreneurial story and a couple other businesses that I've gotten to decent scale, like I always think back on, to your point, like, you know, everything's going great. We're standing around high-fiving each other. You know, it was still really, really hard. Like the customer economics worked great. We had people giving us capital at good valuations. We weren't having too much trouble finding good people in North Carolina to recruit in on technology and sales and customer service and all the different departments we needed, marketing, corporate finance, finding good investors. Like we had, you know, lots of things were going really, really good for us. And it was still really, really, really hard. And this is something I share with entrepreneurs that are in kind of early stages of businesses now, which is that, you know, it is a struggle and it's always a battle to get things started. But if it is just an absolute slog, as in like the customers don't want to pay as much or they're canceling or all these things in the early stages, then, you know, the last thing you want to do is scale those problems up, right? So looking back on my own story, yeah, it was like pristinely simple. And so then we were able to take that and scale it up, which then makes it a big old mess again, right? Because once you take this iteration and, you know, if you think about it with like, you know, variance inside of an engine or a piston, right? If it's going up and down slowly and it's not wobbling too much, that's fine. You can crank up the speed. But once this thing's going, you know, 10,000 RPMs, that little tiny wobble at a small scale is now a massive shake, potentially enough to destroy the entire engine. And it's amazing to think back and yeah, at the unit level, all these things were going so well, but as we scaled up, yeah, massive complexity came into it. You know, I spent my entire 20s on this business. So we technically co-founded it in 2003. So I would have been 22 then. Like I shared, I'd been working on it for several years before that. And then we sold the business in 2012, just in the beginning, February 2012. And it was actually 2 weeks before my 31st birthday. So really it was from like 22 to age 30. So I spent, you know, at that time, it was a third of my life. It was my only, you know, professional working years at that time. I started in college and ran it all the way through 2012. And this was my primary focus. We still had so many challenges. We were super young. We thought we knew a lot about the software side and we did enough to get started, but then we brought in amazing team members around us that actually knew technology. We knew we didn't know anything about raising capital. And so we brought in some pretty senior advisors. Our CFO, Tim Oakley, who joined us very early on, helped us when we decided that we wanted to raise capital. He decided to join our team and we went out together and he had a ton of experience doing that. So we were able to follow along with him. You know, it was $10 million in revenue, let's say. So that would have been like 2007, 2008, when personally for me, I just felt like the wheels were falling off this thing. And it wasn't the business that the wheels were falling off of. It was me. I was just so in over my head. We had these amazing investors that flew in from out of town. And even the concept of like investors who like flew in on an airplane just to visit with us for 4 hours and then got on an airplane and flew back to Baltimore or back to DC at the time was just amazing to me that like anyone would get on an airplane and spend their entire day to just come and have a meeting with us. All these things started to kind of pile up and just feel really, really intimidating. These guys had looked at hundreds of businesses and so they had a lot of experience across, you know, looking at trends and being able to find patterns. I looked at my business every day for years. I hadn't looked at a lot of other things. And so I started to really feel maybe a little bit outclassed by all the folks that I was working with, which was good in a lot of ways, because these were people that made an equity investments, or these were top executives and employees that we were all kind of in the boat paddling in the same direction. I just started to feel kind of a little insignificant and felt like I was, you know, I didn't have the skills that I wanted. And I was, Ryan and I think if we did one thing really well, it was trying to increase our skills as fast as we possibly could. We read tons of things. We joined Entrepreneurs Organization and we started showing up to entrepreneur peer groups and forums. We went to Fortune tech conferences. We went to all sorts of events and content, and we read every book we could possibly find in order to try and improve as fast as we could. It just was really, really challenging. And we were often put in situations that we had absolutely zero experience in. And for me, that started to add up over time, the cost of that.
Yeah. And, you know, you're young and you're mentioning your challenges, but at the same time, you feel strong as an ox. Like, you're young, right? Like, you've got this vitality that we have in our youth, and you're going through this. And as you're ratcheting up the business, things are going well, and you have these investors coming in, and you're about to, and I might get the timing wrong, so correct me, because I want to make sure we're accurate in the story, but you're looking to potentially exit and take like a massive life-changing exit, and something kind of changes and jumps in at that time. What happened there?
So timing-wise, you know, it's interesting. It never really started to feel real until I started to get scared of losing it. And that's something that I don't know if I could have prevented, I could have done any differently, if I could have been coached through it differently or had better mental fortitude. But as it started to grow, I remember my VP of business development, who was, you know, standing to make millions and millions of dollars in our business, coming to me one day and saying, I know we're shooting big, but like, we've really got this locked in. Like, you know, this is going to be a big one. And that was an exciting thing for him to say and for us to both think about in that moment. But it also really kind of incited terror in me, this thought of like, wow, there's another person who I really value, who's done amazing things for me, who's like kind of counting the chickens, right? Like, they're already there. And in my mind, it was like, man, I'm one step from totally effing this thing up tomorrow, right? And I'm on the skin of my teeth trying to get by. And the business was strong then. I just felt like I didn't, you know, if a big problem was going to get thrown our way the next day, I wasn't confident that I necessarily was going to be able to solve that. So the first big monkey wrench for me was in 2009, sitting at my desk and having what kind of played out to ultimately be a panic attack. And at the time, it felt like, you know, I did what I think most entrepreneurs do, is I felt stressed out. So the stress was preventing me from sleeping well. I was busy and I didn't have time to go exercise, or I wasn't making time to go exercise. And the kind of triple whammy of it is that, like a lot of entrepreneurs, when I felt the stress coming on, my solution was to work harder, because I thought the best thing to do would be to just get some stuff off my to-do list, right? Got this massive list of things that need to get done. You know, when I get to the bottom of that to-do list, everything will be fine. And not really being open to the reality that as an entrepreneur, my to-do list basically only grows. it's an exercise of prioritization. There's never a bottom to this to-do list. So at that time, thinking, you know what, I'm just going to outwork this problem, and I'm going to outwork the things I don't know by reading the most and learning the most and doing the most amount of work all at the same time. And I'm going to try and do every one of these things at once. And I'm sitting at my desk and I just feel my heart racing, and I'm probably like gripping my hands, and you know, I'm probably in like a full body, you know, like fully tensed up, not even realizing it. My heart starts racing and I think, oh, that's kind of a weird thing. It feels like I'm sprinting. So I follow along some medical follow-ups for that and come out of it after a couple of days, you know, going all the way to a full like stress echocardiogram, where they make you run on a treadmill with electrodes hooked up to you and they watch what your heart does under pressure. And I come out of it and they say, everything looks fine. You know, you're healthy as can be. I'm like 28 years old, 27 years old. They're like, clearly you're not having a heart attack because you're too young for that. You know, by chance, have you been under any stress recently? And I'd heard that before. I think I'd gone in for a couple of things in the past that weren't quite as acute as this. And every time, oh, your blood pressure is running a little high for a guy in your mid-20s. That's a little weird. Have you been under any stress recently? And that was kind of a trend at the time. Fast forward a year later, and I go in for some medical checkups, actually unrelated to health and stress at the time. Actually, I was going on an adventure to the other side of the world to go do a little bit of mountaineering. And I was just doing some kind of standard medical consults before that. And we find a little lump in my neck. And I forget exactly, I blocked so much of this, I guess, out of my long-term memory that I literally don't remember who discovered it or when, but I know that out of that process came some investigation trying to figure out what this is. And about 4 months later, it took a while to get it confirmed, but I ended up being diagnosed with metastatic thyroid cancer, which is cancer that had started in my thyroid in my neck. At the time, I didn't even know what a thyroid is or where it was, or if I even had one, but mine turned out to be covered in cancer and it had spread to both sides of my neck to about 40 lymph nodes on either side. And it was, you know, the immediate discussion at the time was less about, you know, are you under any stress? It was more about, let's get this thing out of there. And we went very kind of tactically into the path to solve it. But here I am in a business that's growing quickly. We're raising tons of capital. I've got, you know, 200 full-time employees. We've got offices in a couple different countries. And it was a forcing function for me to take some time off. I just couldn't go through the treatment to save my life while continuing to work. And it was the first time that I actually pulled back and tried to try out this kind of weird model of maybe working a little bit less would be better for me. And it wasn't that I had that great epiphany, like stress is killing me. It was more of like, let me not die first and then I'll come back and figure out what to do next. But it gave me a really unique experience in pulling back from a business that otherwise I would not have had the discipline to pull back from.
Yeah. And, you know, and that must've been so hard. I remember you telling me Ryan was super supportive of your treatment and saying, hey, you do what you need to do. I've got this, you go off and do that. But, you know, that still must've been hard for you to distance yourself from the only world in life that you really knew. I mean, were you thinking that you might not return back to eye contact? Like what was going through your mind at the time?
Yeah. You know, that never crossed my mind. I think I did a good job of keeping a positive outlook on the treatment. And, you know, my actual prognosis was good because I was young. Thyroid cancer, when it presents in people older than age 40, is a really significant risk. For me, I had a pretty high chance of survival despite the metastatic nature of it that had actually spread to other organs in the body. Look, it was terrifying for the first several weeks when I didn't know what it was. We knew it was cancer. We didn't know where it was. And even months as I did scans to figure out where else it went in the body. And we ended up discovering that luckily it hadn't gone too far. And we think we could go in and cut it out and then do radiation to get the rest of it. And so as we started to kind of wrap our head around what the challenge was going to be, it became a little bit less scary. I still had to go in and, you know, go fight the fight. Yeah, Ryan was absolutely supportive and my team was absolutely amazing. It was a great experience in that, like, you know, well, since I came out of it, it was a great experience. It was a great learning experience for me, kind of like, you know, being out trail running and, you know, you surprise a grizzly bear and it stands up in front of you, right? Like it's the only thing you look at in that moment is, oh God, there's a bear and it wants to eat me. I'm going to do whatever I need to do, right? This was the same sort of thing. So I don't remember even thinking too much about the business. You know, if there had been a 70% chance the business was going to fail if I pulled back, I still would have pulled back. Like it was so absolute in its intensity and its importance that you know, nothing else really would have mattered at the time. So, you know, I give myself credit for at least focusing on the right priority in the moment. One of the only pieces of memorabilia that I still keep and drag around with me everywhere that I moved to Colorado last year is about a 3-foot by 3-foot piece of foam board that folds open that that my employees created. It was just kind of a big get well card, and they I think Justin and our deliverability team hand drew a huge you know, Tar Heel logo on the front of it, and then you fold it open to the inside and it has the signatures of everybody in the company saying, you know, heal up and get well. And you know, that's my strongest memory from that moment. I don't remember much else actually from that year. It's weird. I don't know whether it was the treatment, it was the radiation, or it was the fear itself. But I oddly did not commit a lot of long-term memories in that year period.
Well, and thankfully you made it through to the other side, and the memories are ones that are positive now in hindsight, right? But so you come back to the company. I mean, how did that change you? How did that change your perspective and how you ran the company and how you approached work and entrepreneur life and as well as life in general?
You know, what's funny to me is that how little in the overall scheme of things that changed me. I would say in the next year to two, you know, I did a lot of reading during my recovery period I remember reading the books. I'm not sure if I remember what the takeaways were, that whole memory problem at the time. But I think what everyone else would say to me is, you know, they'd ask the typical questions, how are you? How's your recovery? All that sort of stuff. And then once we got through that, I'd say, you know, wow, what a life experience. You know, what have you learned or that sort of things. And the word that constantly came up was perspective. I would say it or they would say it like, oh man, it really gives you perspective. And it did give me perspective. And then that perspective went away and I went back to work. It maybe took a year or two. And here I was back in the midst of things. So luckily it wasn't even 3 years until we sold the business. But I kind of went back to work and got focused, and we started running into big problems in the business as it was growing in 2011. And so we had serious challenges that we were trying to solve. And I think it ended up being a little easier than I would have ever imagined to forget this horrific incident and just kind of go back to work and to fall back in the same patterns that I had before. And what I think is really interesting about that is, so we sold in 2012, and I'd gotten a little bit antsy in the last 18 months of the business. And I dropped my operational role, didn't have any direct reports. And I was chairing the board of directors, which was still a chunk of work and really a chunk of stress, because we were trying to solve some pretty big problems, and these things, no one could seem to figure them out. So they kept boiling up higher and higher. So these things were like board level strategy things that we were trying to solve. I used a little bit of the extra free time that I picked up there, not to really find myself again or to do the things that I loved in life, but to go work on other stuff. So I started another company, and it was just kind of a side project. And I went out and got a little bit of financing through a grant program, actually, in North Carolina, that does like a non-dilutive cash grant in order to try and stimulate the economy in North Carolina, and grabbed about $50,000 from that organization, did some pitches there and got selected and started bringing in contractors. And I was working on the next thing. And as it happened, we ended up selling. So I think I got that grant in November of 2011, and we ended up selling iContact in February 2012. So just a couple months later. So here I was.
And it was like a massive exit, right? I mean, the published number is $180 million to a public company. Granted, we'll make the caveat that all didn't go to Aaron, but
that's right. They did not give it all to me.
Yeah. Correct.
Still upset about that. No.
But it's a incredible achievement. It's a life-changing exit. It's the dream of most entrepreneurs. And so you exit and you're now involved in this new company, and we can pick it back up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I remember doing one thing, a couple of good friends, some from inside the iContact business, and a couple others went out and met up in Lake Tahoe, and we rented a big house on the mountain. I love to ski. We went skiing for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. We had a great time. And that's kind of the one thing that I remember celebrating. Other than that, I just remember like getting back to work again. Was like, all right, well, I've got a bunch of money now. I guess I need a financial advisor. And, you know, hey, maybe we'll buy a new house. You know, that'd be kind of cool. And our cars are getting kind of old. Maybe we'll get a new car. Didn't do anything too crazy immediately. But I just kind of kept working. So I had this other company that was small. We had a product. And I thought, hey, let's see if I can get this product to market in 3 or 4 months. And let's go back to the races again. And what I started to discover is, you know, fast forwarding a couple years into that business now, I'm working, you know, I'm not working 80 hours a week or 60 hours a week anymore. But I'm working, you know, 40, 50 hours a week on the startup. And we've got a small team of 4. We've got a couple hundred small paying customers. So like the iContact business, I'm still selling into kind of a small business market. So these people are paying us about $75 a month. So I don't have anyone with massive million-dollar contracts that's, you know, pushing me around and trying to get more out of me. You know, I've got these small kind of customers and small contracts, and we're adding more. And I find myself completely stressed out. And I've got the same amount of stress that I'm holding and the amount of intensity for this little tiny business that has, you know, 15 grand a month in revenue total. That I did in this business where I had millions of dollars on the line. And, you know, if we didn't sell, I wouldn't have millions of dollars on the line. And, you know, I'm a paper multimillionaire and all these things that are creating tension in my life, to being in this small startup. And here I am being this stressed out again. And I started to discover over a little bit of time that, that I must be doing something wrong, or starting to kind of come to the epiphany myself that the stress that I'd put myself through in the past was what sort of had momentum to it. That what I knew how to do as Aaron the entrepreneur was be really stressed out. And so when I sold my company, I went immediately looking for something else that would provide me the ability to be really stressed out. And when you think about that, it sounds really backwards, right? Like, stress doesn't feel good, right? So why would somebody do it? But stress also comes with lots of rewards. When you work hard and you work lots of hours, you often do a good job on things. You often get selected for awards. You get often have customers say, hey, thanks for staying up till 4 a.m. last night and getting that code commit through. You know, you really delivered for me. You start to get positive feedback, and that sort of stuff became addictive. And what I realized over a couple of years in that business, we sold just over a year ago, about 13 months ago, what I started to realize was that I needed to find who I was and what I liked again, because for my entire working career at that point, I'd been going so hard and charging in one direction that I'd really forgotten what actually makes me happy, what makes Aaron happy. And what I'd gotten really good at was making everybody else happy. Or trying to. I'm sure I pissed off a lot of people along the way too, but thinking I was making everybody else happy at least. And I was really spending my time and kind of living my life in my early 30s with this big exit, big enough that I never have to work again, getting myself stressed out, trying to make everybody else happy and putting myself last like I'd done for the last decade.
You realize, hey, I need to make Aaron happy. So what are you doing now to address that? Like, what's that look like?
One is trying to unwind the anxiety. The anxiety piece of it, you know, when I talk to entrepreneurs about their story and building their businesses and whether they've had exits or they're in the stress at the moment, you know, I hear a lot about depression and anxiety. For me, it was, I just got really good at anxiety. It was a pattern that I learned over so many years, just getting myself really, really, really wound up about everything. Certainly had, you know, some mild sort of depressive period, certainly when the businesses weren't doing well, or sometimes we just have challenges in the business that were so hard to solve that I would feel despair. But I was lucky to never get really, really, really low on the depressive side. And I've heard lots of other entrepreneurs do. And I feel very blessed that I just somehow kind of avoided that, for the most part. But anxiety was the one that, man, that one just got me right on. So unwinding this anxiety piece of it, like I found that even not running a business, when I sold the last business in September of 2017, I had a co-founder named Daniel Smith. And so he and I sold the business in September, just over a year ago. And it was really, and I said at the time, I was like, look, I continue to perpetuate this stress thing and this anxiety thing. I'm going to take some time off. And I actually expected the sort of like waking up in the morning early with my email in my face and having trouble falling asleep at night because I was so wound up. I couldn't stop thinking about the problem that had come up, or, you know, I can't believe that partner said that to me today or whatever, just getting completely wound up on it. I thought that would go away when I took my year off. And what I found a couple months into it was that stuff was still there, even though it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a specific thing. Like, I wasn't obsessed about a specific problem, but my mind still raced when I tried to go to sleep. I woke up in the morning and it wasn't an email that triggered me and made me upset. It was just nothing. And I would get up and I would be a ball of nerves, just completely high strung and wound up. And I started looking at myself and thinking, you know, wow, I thought this stuff was going to go away when I got rid of the business. I kind of always blamed the business on the stress. And what I'd realize is that, you know, I had adopted all of these traits and characteristics and they'd really become me. So to your question, what have I done this last year to try and unwind it? Just about everything. And I don't know what the magic pill is yet. So I'm spending this year, as I say, I've been telling folks recently, I'm 13 months into my year off. So I finally found something that I'm really good at. we're probably continuing for a few months, at least maybe another year. I'm spending a lot of my time right now on a passion project. I figured I've been in kind of production and execution mode for the last nearly 20 years, since age 17 when I started my first business to age 37 that I am now. I want to work on really flexing the creativity muscle and trying to be creative again and producing things, not to have them be immediately judged or evaluated by myself or others like my work output has been in the past, and really focus on just doing things to be creative. And so the big idea that I've come up with is to write a book about how entrepreneurs experience and manage stress. And so I'm interviewing lots of entrepreneurs and asking them questions about, you know, why did you start your business? What was your dream? Did making money accomplish it? And so it's kind of my own personal therapy, asking the questions that I wish I had been asked and going through that with entrepreneurs. And I'm collecting a bunch of these stories to kind of tell the cumulative story of what it costs to be successful as an entrepreneur. It costs a lot. It costs time. It costs physical health. My business partner, Ryan, and I, Ryan's a little shorter than I am. I'm 6'4", but he and I collectively together gained 100 pounds in our first 5 years working together. I got about 60 of it and he gained about 40 of it. You see this with a lot of people, a lot of entrepreneurs as well. And then the mental health side of it, right? Like these are things that we're actually exchanging tokens for and spending money in those categories in order to be successful. So I'm putting together a lot of these stories and then pulling a lot of stories about what, I'm asking entrepreneurs, what have you done to mitigate this? Some entrepreneurs are way smarter than I was, and they have like absolute lines in the sand they draw around their physical and mental health and their relationships that they don't cross. And they're going to be successful as long as they're allowed to be successful with these rules in place. And I didn't. I said I was going to be successful and damned if anything was going to get in the way, you know, let alone my measly little mind or body. I was going to just plow right through those resources and be successful no matter what. So I'm collecting a lot of these stories about what people have done to try and be healthy in mind and body and be successful. And I'm honestly trying a lot of the things that people are telling me. So I'm collecting, kind of making a toolbox of these things that ultimately this is what the book will share, is to share a lot of stories of stress and tribulation and real stories from entrepreneurs. And I've got some amazing ones so far that are just like, you know, I could rewrite episodes of the TV show Silicon Valley with these real examples that are way worse than the fictitious stuff, and then share with people a toolbox of things that they could potentially pull from. I'll tell you one thing that really helped me about a year ago was sitting down with one of my EO forum mates and having him walk me through a really simple line of questioning around what makes me happy. And the first place we went was backing up to, when was the last time you would say that you were really happy? Yes, Mark asked me that question. And I started going back to kind of high school and playing sports and spending time with friends. And, you know, I completely had to go all the way back before being an entrepreneur. Even my exit, you know, my exit was exciting and it was thrilling and it was all these things. And I was proud of it, but it wasn't necessarily happy. It was weird. It was a different thing for me. So I had to go back pretty far, and I started looking at all the activities that I used to participate in back then. And I found this amazing mismatch. It was all the things that made me happy. I hadn't done most of them for the last 15 years. I just hadn't done them at all. Simple things like going mountain biking, you know, watching my diet and eating healthy. I added a mindfulness routine to my life that I don't get perfect every day now by any means, but it's a tool I can pull from when I have the discipline to use it and when I need it. So that can be yoga. It can sometimes just be kind of mindless exercise, like going for a run around town, let's say, or maybe going for a simple bike ride that isn't too interesting. meditation, a bunch of different things that just kind of help calm my mind down. I'm 13 months into this process now. And one of the big questions I've been asking people as I've been going through this process is, if I spent 20 years building bad habits, how long does it take to undo 20 years of bad habits? And I've heard a couple things that give me a lot of hope really consistently. One was very tactical. I just heard this last week from an EO speaker at EO University, San Francisco, who said that for every year you spent building bad habits, you need about 1 month of intentional good habits to undo them. And the other piece of tactical advice I got was from a therapist who said that, you know, it takes significantly less time than it did to build those bad habits, because typically you build the bad habits unintentionally. She wouldn't tell me exactly how long she thought, but she thought that with intentionality around building new habits and also creating kind of a new context and new environment. For instance, if you want to go running in the morning, you put your running shoes by the door and your running clothes already next to them, right? You set yourself up to success by kind of building the environment to support it. So doing that in all the different areas of kind of physical and mental health in my life, that I could lay the groundwork to actually changing these habits significantly faster than it's taken to build them. So 13 months in, you know, how far am I on this journey? I don't know, 30, 40, 50%. I don't feel like I can see the end immediately in sight. And that kind of makes it a fun journey. I'm excited to be engaged in this process to get back to being a healthy person again.
Oh, I love it. And I love your public declaration about your book. You heard it here first, or maybe not first, but you've heard it here on the podcast that Aaron's going to put this book out. And it's a topic that I am also personally very interested in, and thinking about like how you protect that sacred time, right? Like, and how you make it work, because it isn't automatic. And I think a lot of people think, well, even if I had all the time in the world, I could do this, I could do that. But even with all the time in the world, it's hard. It's all about values and priorities. And so
really looking forward to your book. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah. I like to ask people that the question that I kind of glossed over in the middle there, but I think maybe this is the question is like, what will it cost you to be successful? Right. And I think that we all maybe fantasize and romanticize over the success side, but don't necessarily consider what it's going to cost to get there. So.
Yeah. Or what you're willing to pay. Right.
And what you're willing to pay. Yeah,
it's a big one.
It may cost more than what the reward is going to be in the end. And I was one of the lucky ones that had a good exit, right? If we're all out shooting for good exits, let's keep in mind that I'm the exception, not even the rule, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, Aaron, we asked this of everyone on the show. If the old you could see the new you, what would the old you say?
Man, the old me was real cynical bastard about guys that look for happiness. So... Yeah, I wish he would say he was proud, but I think unfortunately he would probably wonder why I'm not being more productive, because the old me only valued productivity and nothing else. So I'm happy to be the new me.
And that is Aaron Houghton. And as a side note, I think starting a painting company is a rite of passage for most entrepreneurs. I had a painting company with my good friend John Bald, the Quality Painting Company, up in Frankfort, Michigan, for a couple summers. And we didn't know how to bid projects, and we always bid high. And often, that's how we were selected. Clients figured we must have been high quality given our name and our pricing. But we were seriously mediocre. And I'll never forget, we won a bid to power wash and stain a deck of a local lawyer in town. And well, we didn't know what we were doing, and we proceeded to destroy that deck in the course of a few hours, blasting it with a power washer, not knowing the first thing about power washing. And I think that might have been the end of the Quality Painting Company. And as we close today's show, let's remember Aaron's message: how important self-care is for all of us. That we lose sight of what's really important, chasing our goals and our number. And in the end, if we don't take care of ourselves and our loved ones, then we won't be around to share our successes. Oh, and what makes me really happy? After Aaron posed that question, I made my own list. Lunch league hockey, yoga, the way my wife Lindsay smiles, snowboarding with friends, getting outside, reading, working on this podcast, Colorado, Northern Michigan, anytime my kids are excited to hang with me, long walks, my office, which is called the Happy House, working with the right clients, travel, my friends, getting 8 hours of sleep, choosing to live where I want. The list goes on, and I'll spare you the rest, but I challenge you to think about what makes you happy and what you're going to do to make it happen. Until next time.
Make sure to visit our website, www.wildstory.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. I like big stories, and I cannot lie. You other storytellers can't deny. Baby got backstory. You'll also find free story downloads and resources to help you integrate the power of story into your business.